This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us. We're here ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
From our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, I'd like to welcome you to our Week in Review Governments in Peril edition. What a week it has been. In the first half of the program today, we're going to talk about four different situations likely to trigger major political changes in four different countries: the United Kingdom, the Jewish State of Israel, Germany, and the United States. We'll start in the UK, where the Prime Minister literally may be out of office by the time we finish recording this program. For this story, we'll go to our man in the UK, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, I'm just hitting refresh on Twitter to check that Theresa May is in fact still there. I mean, maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but she is on very thin ice right now. So on Wednesday, she came back from the European Union and she basically showed the senior members of government, this is the result of our couple of years of negotiation about Brexit. This is something that there's still a little bit of wriggle room, but this is pretty much what we've agreed on as the blueprint for Europe to leave for Britain to leave the EU. She presented that to the government, and since then it's been an absolute train wreck, and it's nearly brought down the government. She was in Parliament yesterday. She was up there, I think, for about 3 hours while basically she was hit by question after question along the lines of, does the Prime Minister agree that her deal is terrible and that she should resign right now? I mean, not quite that bad, but as a Conservative Prime Minister, you're going to get a lot of abuse from Labour, from the opposition party. What really stood out about this debate is that she got a whole lot of abuse from her own side. Some political commentators have been comparing it to the famous 1940 debate about the disastrous invasion of Norway that led to the end of Neville Chamberlain's government and that brought in Winston Churchill, because that debate just showed he didn't command any kind of respect of his own party anymore. Mm-hmm. That's what we're looking at with Theresa May. Now, having said that, she is coming out fighting. She says she's not going to be intimidated easily. I think there are plenty of other past prime ministers who would have resigned by now, and she hasn't. So it's not a foregone conclusion that she's going to go either. Whatever happens, it's a major moment of turmoil for British politics.
Okay, so focus in on the substance of their criticisms against her. This is essentially a fundamental conflict over the nature of how Brexit is going to be implemented.
Yes, pretty much. I mean, she's come back with a deal that has upset a whole lot of people, even people who were kind of, I would say, I don't know, Brexit pragmatists or Brexit moderates, who were willing to give ground in quite a few areas to the EU, have been pretty critical of the deal that she's come back with. Basically, it commits Britain to being in a transition period with the EU until, and I quote, 20XX. So we could be in a transition period with the EU, according to this deal, all the way up until 2099. That's quite a long time.
Uh-huh.
And the deal, Article 7 of the deal itself, it says that all references to member states shall be understood as including the UK. So the deal basically means that it could end up with Britain being stuck in the European Union, but without having any power over its rules. So in an even worse position than we were before. Now, a lot of this gets back to what people think about the European Union. This is kind of the worst case scenario. It's called the backstop. And so this is, okay, if we don't agree anything, that's what's going to happen. the trouble is the EU has Britain cannot leave this backstop arrangement without Europe's permission. So the ones that are more trusting of Europe kind of say, well, this is a backstop. It's probably not going to happen. We're all going to try and avoid it. I think the ones that have a much more realistic position of the much more vindictive nature of the European Union, the dictatorial nature of the European Union, if you look at the way that it has trodden on any nation that does what it doesn't want, to persuade the EU to behave in a pleasant and gentlemanly fashion, which if it did behave like that, maybe this deal would work. But that's just, you know, that's just fantasy. And so the ones that don't expect the EU to behave that way, to expect the EU to use every advantage it could grab, they're the ones that are being much more critical of this deal. The other big part of it is that it gives them that Northern Ireland is pretty much, again, unless the EU unilaterally lets them go, is almost stuck forever, even outside of 2099, forever in this kind of being part of the European Union, split off from the rest of the UK. They'd still obviously be part of the UK, but subject to different laws. And a lot of people are very worried that you start doing that and you're on your way to breaking up the United Kingdom and into all kinds of problems.
So looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, obviously when the British public voted to leave the European Union, we drew a lot of attention to that because of what Herbert W. Armstrong had prophesied, the fact that Britain was not going to be a part of that European unification project ultimately, and that it would look back on the day that it joined that effort as a real problem, that it was going to create serious problems for that nation down the road. Maybe you could just summarize the prophecies. And Stephen Fleury has been talking about this on his show. He talked about it quite a bit this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. The major points that we're looking at from a prophetic standpoint.
Right. So, yeah, Herbert W. Armstrong said, well, it's a day fraught with ominous potentialities when Britain joined the European Union. And we're seeing that it's, you know, those ominous potentialities aren't so easy to get rid of, even having voted to leave the European Union. It's not so simple as, well, that ends all of the problems. Mr. McDonald, we've got an article from Brad McDonald as well that we'll get up sometime either towards the end of this week or beginning of next week. He basically asked the question, well, is Britain strong enough to do this? Does it have the leadership that it needs, the unity that it needs, just the general moral fiber that it needs to make a success of Brexit, for, you know, taking back control of its destiny? That's great, but that's also quite a challenging task. Does Britain have the moral fortitude to come through this?
Yeah.
And what we're seeing more and more is no, they don't. But the point that Mr. Fleury made this morning, the other point that I thought was really powerful, that unites a whole lot of the other news stories that we've seen this week, like we talked about last week with Macron's comments about a European army, is just the way that Europe is turning against both Britain and America. That they're making, you know, they're saying we need an army to defend against America. They're making these very, very harsh requests or demands on Britain to leave the European Union. And Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he was writing about this, and he said no nation would normally agree to such terms unless very small or bankrupt or first defeated in war. He compared it to the note that Austria passed on to Serbia in 1914 as something that they could not possibly accept.
Right.
So you're seeing this hostility. The other actually point that Ambrose Evans Pritchard makes in that his article, which I think is really fascinating, is that he says, well, this could lead to Britain walking away from this deal. That could be catastrophic for Britain's economy. It could also be catastrophic for Europe's economy. And he talks about how that could potentially be transformational for Europe, talking about even bringing the AfD to power in Germany, revolutionizing Europe's economy. So that will be something interesting to watch. That would be another side of Bible prophecy that we've been watching. We've talked about how an economic crisis could bring major changes to Europe. Britain turning away from Europe in the wake of this very harsh deal, that could precipitate some of that. But what we've seen is Britain turn to Europe since the 70s, put its trust in Europe, and it's not worked out well. And as Mr. McDonald goes through in his article, the root cause of that is found in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Britain has rejected God, rejected even traditional morality that it had a certain amount of during the days of its empire. And you've seen the blessings that God gave to this nation being taken away. Leaving the European Union, a lot of people said, well, this is going to solve all of Britain's problems. It didn't solve that fundamental problem. And so, great, we're on our way out of Europe. Those curses continue. All of the bad news continues until, you know, it's the turning around to God that needs to change before there's going to be any long-term change in the nation. And our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, will explain why that is, why Britain is talked about in the economy, why we're in just such a horrible position right now. I saw a tweet this week. Someone wrote, really enjoying the drama in the last season of the UK. That right. captures some of the feeling that there is in the UK right now with these news events. But that book will explain why it feels like the end of the UK right now.
Yeah. Well, it definitely makes you wonder whether Britain will ever find its footing and a measure of stability in light of the disorder and the disarray within its leadership at this point. You could easily foresee this being a plague on that nation from this point forward. To imagine someone actually stepping up and bringing this to a competent conclusion, it's difficult to foresee that happening. But we will keep our eyes on that, and it is good to just view that in light of what Herbert Armstrong said in The United States and Britain in Prophecy. He talked about the sun setting on the British Empire and on Britain decades ago, and we're seeing this continue slow dimming of the light in that part of the world and in compliance with exactly what God said was going to happen. We appreciate that very much. Richard, over to Israel now. We heard on our program on Wednesday about the relentless attacks coming from Gaza into the Jewish state. Well, disagreement among Israeli leaders over how to handle this threat is boiling over. For this story, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, as we even talked about on Wednesday's show, just the fact that Israel came under such a huge attack from Hamas on Monday evening to Tuesday evening, the Israeli public was really expecting Israel to come on strong in retribution to Hamas and use this as motivation to go to war, basically, against Hamas and really cut them down to size so they can't do this again, at least for another couple of years. And yet, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, for reasons that we don't fully understand, he decided to not go ahead and do that, and he accepted a ceasefire. And as a result of that, you did see, or we saw this week on Wednesday, the Defense Minister, Avigdor Lieberman, he leads a separate party in the Knesset that's part of the coalition of Mr. Netanyahu. And the five seats that he had with his party have been removed from the coalition, basically with his departure from the defense ministry role as well, which has brought Mr. Netanyahu's coalition to only having a one seat majority, 61 seats in the 120 seat Knesset. And so it's very divided right now over this. Now, the defense minister himself, he's been trying to have a harder response to Hamas for probably about a year and a half. And he is calling and disagreed with Netanyahu's response a number of times. But what he's seen is he's basically a figurehead in Netanyahu's government because the prime minister keeps on trumping him, trumping what he thinks is most important. So he's gone right now. And many people think that this is going to end up with early elections being called sometime early next year.
So with 61 seats still, why would this precipitate a new election?
Well, it is interesting. I mean, Israel itself, it's the way its Knesset is set up. There's so many parties, separate parties. I forget the number that's a part of the ruling coalition of Mr. Netanyahu, but Likud, his party, only has 20 plus seats of that 60. And so there are a number of other parties that are in his coalition that are threatening to leave also, especially if they don't get what they want. Now you've got this defense ministry portfolio that's up for grabs. Somebody wants it. He has to be a member of the Knesset. And so right now you've got Naftali Bennett, who leads the Jewish Home Party, who's even more desirous of war against Hamas than Avigdor Lieberman was. He's basically come out and said, if you don't give me the defense portfolio, we're out as well. And if we go, then you don't have a majority and you're going to have to call early elections. And so what we're seeing right now, and what is so, in a way, heartbreaking for the Israeli people right now, is right amidst a period of war, of where you need decisive action from your government. You have political infighting and jockeying inside the conservative government, where people are trying to use the situation for their own political gain. And I'd say the prime minister, in a way, as well, in this. And what happens, you know, or what doesn't, the big deal is nothing really is going to get done for a while, as far as the Hamas threat goes. And so we will find out. I think we'll probably find out by the end of the day, today or tomorrow, whether early elections are called. That would mean that come in the next few months, we're going to have a new election. And then Mr. Netanyahu, hopefully he'll try and get in power again. The thing that Mr. Netanyahu has in his favor is the fact that there is no real leader in Israel that people trust for their protection outside of him. You do have some others that are willing to give a firm hand, a strong response against terrorists. But as far as, you know, the diplomatic sense, the fine line that Israel has to walk in its relations with other nations, Europe, United States, no one is as well averse as that as Mr. Netanyahu. So we'll see, I mean, how it goes going forward, but it isn't a pretty picture politically here in Israel right now.
It would be ironic, I guess, if Netanyahu, if his leadership were threatened because he wasn't hawkish enough. And just looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, I suppose you could see this playing out in a few different ways. But you mentioned that there would be people who would be willing to take a firmer hand. And one would presume with Lieberman making the move that he did, that he's hoping that it would move in that direction. But one wonders how likely it would be to go that way. If Israel did get a leader who was even more hawkish, then how might that play out? Or is it possible that even with the elections being called, if it goes that direction, being precipitated by someone who wants firmer action, that it could actually end up with someone who was weaker than Netanyahu?
It certainly could. That could happen. But right now, the Israeli public is firmer and wants a firmer response than the government itself. Already, Lieberman's party, there was a poll that was conducted. It's gained seats since this reaction, since his departure. People want a firmer response, and so I can't see the government going towards a left wing or even a centrist party right now, given the threat. And we know in terms of Bible prophecy, we really do expect Israel to have firm right wing or a conservative government, a government that's willing to put up a fight against Hamas and the other Iranian backed terrorist groups that fight against Israel. The Bible indicates that the Palestinians are going to make a play for East Jerusalem and try and take that over violently, and Israel is going to respond with force to those moves of the Palestinians. And so that indicates that you're going to have a harder right wing, you could say, government in power. If people want to understand more about that and why we believe a right wing government is going to stay in power, at least in terms of when these biblical prophecies are being fulfilled, they can read our book, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Last week, Angela Merkel announced her intention to step down as head of her political party. Well, this week, another resignation created even more political intrigue in Germany. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so the leader of Angela Merkel's sister party, the Christian Social Union, Horst Seehofer, he announced that he would also step down. He announced this on Monday, and then today he came and he gave some more details. He said that the Christian Social Union is going to hold a special conference on the 19th of January, and they're going to elect a new party leader on that date. So they're also going to hold an executive meeting on December 17th. So he's basically said he's stepping down and he's fired the starting gun on the race to replace him as Angela Merkel's, the leader of Angela Merkel's sister party. Now, there's a whole number of reasons why this is significant, why we're watching, say, the leadership of a smaller German party. One is the head of the CSU is a position where you're in line to be chancellor. So for example, Edmund Stoiber, who was Horst Seehofer's predecessor, he ran for chancellor. He was supported by both the CSU and Angela Merkel's party, the CDU, mm-hmm. I think it was back in 2000. So this is still a high profile political job. Job. Then, as the Spectator pointed out earlier in the week, you're seeing just this departure of all of the big beasts from German politics, with Merkel going, now Seehofer going. These people that have dominated German politics for 20 years. I mean, both these individuals really were dominant in their parties. They're stepping down now, and you're looking at a whole new generation of leadership coming in now with less experience, less name recognition, but just a whole brand of new leaders. But then the final reason we're watching this, you know, anytime we're talking about a leader in Germany, and if you've listened to the show, you'll have heard about this, we talk about Karl-Theodor zu Gutenberg. And the Bible talks about a strong leader coming in Europe. It talks about this in Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11. And for a number of reasons, for about 10 years or so, we've said, well, we think zu Gutenberg could be that man. We've got an article by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry in the next Trumpet print edition that explains more about why we're watching zu Gutenberg, why we think he could be that individual. And when Merkel stepped down, we immediately said, well, you know, watch zu Gutenberg. The CSU, Horst Seehofer's party, is zu Gutenberg's party. So now we're seeing some leadership turmoil within zu Gutenberg's own party. He was forced to resign from German politics in 2011. There have been repeated calls for him to come back into politics. As recently as last year, Spiegel said if he wanted to the leadership of the party, he could just walk back into German politics and take it. Even just in the spring this year, the Britain's Express newspaper referred to him as a possible successor to Angela Merkel. So even though he's out of politics, and has been out of politics for 7 years, he is not out of people's minds.
Yeah.
So now you're having this leadership upheaval right at the top of his party. And even if he doesn't stand, say, in this particular election, that upheaval could start to bring him back into politics. And Seehofer has been very keen to bring zu Gutenberg back into politics. Seehofer doesn't like some of the top contenders within the party to replace him. He has a feud with Markus Söder, that's the most likely person, I guess, to get his job. And he sees zu Gutenberg as about one of the only people who could block those individuals. He's tried in the past to get zu Gutenberg back into politics. Is he going to try before January? And then that date, January 19th, is just really interesting as well. If you listen to this program, you know that we put a bit of focus on January 16th. And that's often a very important date to watch. And now you have this event going on January 19th. So it'll be really interesting to see what goes on with that leadership challenge.
So it doesn't sound like you have any specific knowledge of what his strategy might be, but the possibility, it does seem like at least he very likely could have a plan for that would work in Gutenberg's favor, having stepped down or made this decision.
Yes. I mean, in some ways, this is a bit like the Theresa May story we were talking about. It's something that's up, that's still ongoing. He only announced the January 19th date today, and he only announced the process that they would go through to replace him today. So not that I know of, nobody so far has officially announced their candidacy, thrown their hat into the ring. We don't have lists of candidates yet, anything like that. It's very early days on this story, but we do know that just he has had repeated meetings with Zu Gutenberg. He's repeatedly tried to kind of groom and persuade Zu Gutenberg to come in and be his heir apparent, or, you know, the crown prince of the party. Zu Gutenberg has refused to do that so far. Now that he's stepping down, it does seem logical that he might try even harder.
The machinations in the politics of so many countries, it's just very cloak and dagger, lots of intrigue and things happening in the shadows and deals being made under the table. What's interesting in particular about Germany is the prophecy that we're looking at that informs this view that we're waiting for this strongman specifically uses that kind of language. It talks about him coming in by flatteries. It uses language that it doesn't sound like a clean democratic ascension to power. And so it does just kind of give this additional sheen of intrigue to everything that we're witnessing there. And I guess we'll just have to keep our eyes open, knowing that in just a couple of months, we're going to have both of these major mainstream parties that have dominated European politics or German politics for generations with new leaders. Exactly how that's going to play out, it remains to be seen. But in light of what the Bible says about it, it's definitely something that gives us a lot to watch for.
Yeah, and we'll keep you up to date with all of those developments as we see them on this show and at thetrumpet.com. But if you want to know much more about the prophecy behind that, because this is something that this leader in Germany has spoken about in a whole load of biblical prophecies. To prove that for yourself, you can get our booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, and that will take you through why Daniel 8, why Daniel 11 are talking about a strong individual in Germany. And then, like I mentioned, keep watching for that article from Mr. Flurry in the Trumpet print. That I think that just went off to print yesterday, so we'll should have that on the website within a couple of weeks, and that will give you just a great background of what you need to know as you watch these events going on in Germany.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Now to America, where results from elections last week still have not been finalized, and the specter of underhanded activities is hovering. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, recounting votes is a bit of a state pastime for Florida. It happens in many elections, probably most famously in the presidential election between George W. Bush and Al Gore in 2000. And anyone who's been following our organization for any period of time knows that we had quite a lot to say about that election, with our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, writing in his book No Freedom Without Law that recount election was even prophesied in the Bible. And we'll get into that momentarily. But just to kind of give a recap as to what's happening in Florida now, the morning after the election, the Republican candidate for governor, Ron DeSantis, was leading by 72,000 votes, and the Republican candidate for Senate, Rick Scott, was leading by 51,000 votes. And then, even though the law explicitly states that even if you're not finished counting the votes, you have to report how many ballots there are 30 minutes after the polls close, they didn't do that. And they've kept finding more and more votes. They found votes in schools. They found votes in rental cars. I think one, there was an Avis rental car at the airport in Broward County, where they found a whole box of provisional ballots 5 days after the election that they sent in, which there's concern because, like, this has been sitting in the parking lot of an airport for 5 days. No one knows if those ballots have been tampered with.
Right.
But yet the new ballots keep pouring in after the 30-minute deadline, after the polls close. They keep counting them, and now the 72,000 vote lead and that 51,000 vote lead have dwindled to too close to call. So I believe they just started. They did another machine count. Still too close to call. They're going through a hand count. They've brought in the Democratic Party's brought in Mark Elias. He's the same lawyer who hired Christopher Steele to do opposition research on the Trump collusion campaign.
Very
campaign with
upstanding gentleman
with Russia to brought in. He's famous for winning a recount for Al Franken in Minnesota some years back. So he's kind of got himself a reputation as the go-to recount guy. Yeah. And now the recount's unfolding, but it looks like it could go either way. And if these ballots are not legitimate ballots, that could be just outright stealing of an election. Even the left-wing papers, something like Vox, has counted five issues, serious issues with how these votes have been counted. Now, the left-wing magazine, they don't call it fraud. They call it incompetence. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the difference between fraud and incompetence really boils down to intent.
Right.
They're like, did they mean to steal the election, or were they just stupid and stole it by accident?
Mm-hmm.
But that will have far-reaching effects for the United States, and is that the Republican Party was mainly focusing on getting Senate seats to appoint conservative judges. And, I mean, they'll get 51 Senate seats, same as they had last time, pretty much no matter what at this point. But now with there's another recount in Mississippi that they could lose as well. So if they lose Mississippi and lose Florida, that would mean the Republicans thought they were going to get, like, three new Senate seats. They lost Arizona already. And ended up with, if they lose both Mississippi and Florida, they'll end up getting no new Senate seats. They'll have the same 51 majority that they had last time, which for judicial confirmations means that it'll end up being like it was during the Brett Kavanaugh nomination, as long as you can get Susan Collins and the pro-abortion Republicans on your side, you might squeeze by, but you don't have much of a margin.
Yeah.
But getting back to what I was talking to at the beginning, back in the 2000 election, in his book No Freedom Without Law, Mr. Fleury writes that it may shock you, but the 2000 presidential election chaos in the U.S. was prophesied in your Bible. And then he goes in to a prophecy in Micah. Now, he describes before that how the United States and Britain are the literal descendants of the ancient tribes of Israel. But then saying that, jumping in Micah 3 in verse 1, it says, "And I say, here I pray you, O heads of Jacob, and you princes of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know judgment? Who hate the good, who love the evil, who pluck off their skin from them, and who flesh off their bones, who also eat the flesh of my people, flay their skin off from them, and break their bones, chop them into pieces, as for the pot, as for the flesh with the cauldron." And this sounds, it's a grisly scripture. It sounds like it's talking about cannibalism. But Mr. Fleury explains here that God is speaking figuratively and spiritually. Our justice system rips off the people's skin, breaks their bones, tears off their flesh, chops them into pieces, throws them into a pot, and eats them. And so this is a really graphic metaphor of just how corrupt the justice system in the United States is going to be in the end time. It gets down to is it the rule of law or is it the rule of lawyers?
Right.
You can be that you can, if the Democratic Party wants to steal an election from the people from what the people voted for, you can bring in a lawyer who's famous for cooking up false Russia collusion stories and stealing elections in other states. Go look around for a few extra boxes of provisional ballots and rental cars across the state and come up with the election you want. And so this is a prophecy, I guess not prophecy specifically about this president versus this president in this
right.
election, but it is a prophecy of just how corrupt the justice system will be in the United States in the end time, that things like this Florida recount can happen.
Yeah. Well, we do have an article about this up on thetrumpet.com by Tim Ostendarp. It's called "The Disturbing Story Behind the Senate Florida Recount." Go check that out. We appreciate that very much. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a couple stories from Asia, including cyber attacks by Russia against NATO and historic enemies China and Japan working together. We'll also talk about new documents showing how close Iran has gotten to having a nuclear bomb and the record-breaking wildfires in California. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
By contrast to all the political upheaval going on elsewhere in the world, the major nations in Asia are quite politically stable. They're ruled over by strongmen who don't take well to efforts to undermine their rule. And as Western nations argue over building their armies, these strongmen are making some pretty aggressive moves with the forces they have. We're going to start here with a story about a cyber attack by Russia against NATO during its recent war games. For this, we'll turn to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia launched a cyber attack on GPS signal in Finland and Norway. And that took place during massive NATO war games that were being held there beginning in, let me see, it was October 25th and ending November 7th. So those attacks happened at that time, according to a statement made this week by Finnish Prime Minister Juha Sipilä. And since Sipilä talked about that, it's also been confirmed by authorities in Norway and NATO authorities as well. And this attack, or what may have been a series of attacks, basically just caused large-scale GPS disruption and forced pilots, including pilots of civilian aircraft, to switch to alternative navigation systems. And Mr. Sipilä said that it should be taken very seriously as airspace violations, partly because it threatened the air security of ordinary people by putting those civilian flights in danger. Sipilä was careful to say that Russia could be the party responsible for these attacks rather than asserting it as a proven fact. But some of the other authorities were bolder in ascribing the blame to Russia. And I think that if you look to some of the recent events leading up to this cyber attack, it really removes any doubt about Russian culpability. First, if we go back to 2016, at that time, Russian President Vladimir Putin issued a severe warning to Finland, basically saying if they join NATO, then Russia would take countermeasures. NATO, of course, is the military alliance of more than two dozen European and North American countries, and Finland is not a member. Officially, Finland is militarily neutral. But ever since Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula back in 2014, the Finns have been becoming more and more interested about the possibility of joining NATO, and they've been cooperating with NATO more and more since then. On a wide number of fronts. So Putin issued that 2016 warning, but then in May of this year, Finland signed a major agreement with NATO that stipulates Finland's full involvement in any NATO military exercises, and it grants Finland access to NATO's command and control and weapon systems. And in exchange, NATO gets full access to Finland's territorial waters and airspace. And of course, Finland lies right along the Russian border there. They share about 800 miles of border. So this was deeply unsettling for the Russians. And the Russian leadership came out after Finland entered into that deal and issued an even more severe threat to the Finns, saying that if they continued cozying up to NATO, then Russia would take countermeasures. So that brings us up to last month and earlier this month, when Finland ignored all of those threats and went ahead with these major military drills with NATO. The drills are called Trident Juncture. It's actually the largest war games NATO has held since the end of the Cold War. And it's now been disclosed that during a portion of those drills, GPS signal in Finland and in Norway was intentionally disrupted in a very dangerous way. And so it's clear that that was part of these countermeasures that Russia had previously threatened the Finns with. Mm.
It is quite remarkable to see just how much this type of strategy, or these types of tactics, are being employed in warfare today. And Russia definitely is trying to position itself at the vanguard of being able to make these kinds of attacks. And we've seen, this is hardly an isolated incident. We've seen quite a lot of this type of activity coming from Russia.
Yes, that's right. This attack on Finland is just one of many that we've seen in recent years. Both Russia and China have increasingly been targeting computer networks and cyber technologies of Western nations. Data has recently come out showing that last year, was the worst year ever for these kinds of cyber attacks. There were an estimated 350,000 major attacks that happened during those 12 months.
That's insane.
It's incredible. And when the authorities are able to trace the source of the attacks, it's very, very often found that the perpetrators were in either Russia or China. Mm-hmm. And the reason why cyber technologies are being targeted so much, well, it's partly because Western nations depend heavily on them, and it's partly because they're also often very vulnerable. And that includes the U.S. military's computer networks and systems, too. Last month, the U.S. Government Accountability Office published a report saying that nearly all, quote, nearly all weapon systems that were being developed by the U.S. Defense Forces from 2012 to 2017 are vulnerable to cyber attacks. Hmm. So this is the weaponry and the systems that we rely on for national security. And yet nearly all of it, according to this report, at least that was built during those years when more and more computer systems were implemented, is vulnerable to cyber attack.
Yeah. Jeremiah has an article in the coming print edition of The Trumpet, the one that we just sent off to the printer yesterday, called China Hacks America and, quote, None Go to Battle. That's a specific reference to a prophecy in Ezekiel 7 and verse 14, and it's one of many prophecies that he lists and expounds on in this article, showing just how much cyber warfare could play a role in the unfolding of events in the end time. I'd really encourage you to stay tuned, look at thetrumpet.com, watch for that article. And there's quite a lot of information in there that is very compelling about just how central this could be to events in the future. Anything else that you would want to point people to for a further understanding on this?
Well, there's also an article that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote. He's actually been keeping a close eye on the cyber vulnerability of the U.S. and the U.S.'s military specifically since the mid-90s. And so we'll include a link in the show notes to one of his early pieces about this. It's called America's Achilles Heel, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Okay, and Jeremiah also has a video that should be posted soon about this specific cyber attack on the NATO war games. You can watch for that as well. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Back to the Middle East now. Alarming new information has emerged regarding Iran's nuclear program. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, Foreign Policy published an exclusive piece this week it was largely driven by interviews that they had with David Albright. He is one of the most knowledgeable people in the world regarding nuclear inspections, nuclear programs. He was a nuclear inspector for the IAEA back in the day, or the UN, I think back in the day with Saddam stockpiles. And so he came out, and he's been traveling to Israel a few times in the past couple of months to go through the massive amount of paperwork that the Israelis discovered from a warehouse inside Tehran back in January this year. And as he's poring over these pages, he is finding details that we didn't know, and he's reporting on them. And the detail that he brought forth this past week was the fact that Iran was far closer to achieving a nuclear bomb, a nuclear warhead, than we expected. Looking at the details, it seems that Iran was 7 to 12 months away from having a nuclear bomb that would have had a 10 kiloton payload. And that Iran also was at first trying to build five of these. And so the information itself only goes up into 2003. But up to that point, that's how close they were, far closer than we knew.
In some ways, it seems like whenever these types of revelations emerge, in one sense, there's nothing surprising about it. And in another, it's amazing how much information there is out there showing the real nature behind Iran's nuclear activities. And in this case, it specifically talks about how involved Hassan Rouhani was behind these activities. This is the man who is the supposed moderate that President Obama was so eager to work with. He was right in the mix.
Yeah, this was one of the key elements to the way that the nuclear deal was sold by the Obama administration and the creation of this echo chamber. that Ben Rhodes talked about, how the fact that, well, not the fact, how they wanted to promulgate this lie that Rouhani, this new president that came into power in Iran in 2013, was a moderate, and this is the time that we have to organize a nuclear deal to stop their program. And as this report brings out, Rouhani's fingerprints are over the nuclear program from the 1990s up into 2003, when it was temporarily suspended. He's the man, he's the figurehead behind it all. And so with the very man that the Obama administration touted as the moderate, that we need to do a deal to stop the nuclear program, was the very man that was behind the whole thing all along. And Albright comes out and says that it doesn't seem that Rouhani has ever given up his nuclear ambitions. And so this is something to remember going forward, given the fact that the Europeans, though they say they want to stay in the nuclear deal, doesn't look like they're going to be able to do it because their governments are fleeing anyway, that Iran might just think, hey, there's no reason for us to stay in this going forward, and let's just get the show back on the road. And at that point, they have 7 to 12 months from a nuclear bomb. And so that's going to push us down a path where somebody is going to have to stand up to them or they'll achieve that nuclear weapon.
Well, it does seem like the amount of evidence that we've had that this is exactly what was on their mind from the very beginning has already been overwhelming. It's hard to imagine that further information, what we're looking at here, would be, say, the piece of evidence that finally convinces them that Iran is a bad actor and untrustworthy in these matters. Still, you would expect, I think you make a good point, that at some point this is going to be recognized as the reality of the situation by European leaders. It does seem like you already see a certain amount of hardening of their position regarding this, and I would expect that would increase based on what we know from Bible prophecy.
Yeah, if people really want to get a good picture of this, they can go ahead and read Warren Reinsch's article. It's called "Iran Got Far Closer to a Nuclear Bomb Than Realized," and it should be up on the Trumpet very soon.
Thanks for that, Brent. Moving on now, Japan and China have been arch enemies for generations, but Bible prophecy says that eventually they're going to be together as part of a Pan-Asian alliance. This week we saw evidence of this extraordinary reconciliation. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China and Japan are holding more and more meetings about the two of them cooperating on projects associated with China's Belt and Road Initiative. That's China's project that, well, it basically aims to rebuild the old Silk Road trade route that went from Europe to China. And they're trying to rebuild that by basically just building all kinds of transport infrastructure and enhancing connectivity along the thousands and thousands of miles between China and Europe. And the most notable of these discussions about cooperation between China and Japan came a few days ago when Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe traveled to Beijing. And during that visit, the Chinese Premier Li Qiong formally invited Japan to cooperate on the Belt and Road Initiative, or the BRI. And there were numerous Japanese and Chinese companies and universities also represented at those meetings. And they agreed to work together on more than 50 infrastructure projects in third countries. So projects in Central Asia and Southeast Asia and elsewhere. And this is really interesting for a few different reasons. But the biggest of those, I think, is what you mentioned a moment ago, which is just the historic rivalry between China and Japan and the intense animosity that these two nations have historically had for each other, especially after World War II, when the Japanese invaded China and were just so barbaric in that invasion. That was 70 years ago now, but the way the collective Chinese memory works, something like that's still a fresh humiliation. And, you know, they're really not at all like the United States or the UK or France, where we seem to have totally forgotten the atrocities of the Axis powers during World War II in a lot of concerning ways. With China, it's very different. The Chinese have never really felt that Japan sufficiently apologized for those ruthless wartime atrocities. And then there's also even some ongoing territorial disputes between China and Japan with the Senkaku or Diu Islands that they both claim, and other parts of the East China Sea that they have territorial disputes over. So there's been plenty of hostility between China and Japan. And even specifically regarding the Belt and Road Initiative, the Japanese for years have been the most vocal critics of the whole project. So the fact that China and Japan are now suddenly holding meetings about cooperating on that, and China seems to be on board with 50 projects, or I mean Japan rather, seems to be on board with 50 infrastructure projects, it really shows that China and Japan may be entering a period of detente and just sort of laying the groundwork to collaborate in some major ways. So this has profound geopolitical implications.
So it does seem interesting that the issue that's uniting Japan and China is specifically trade with Europe.
Yes, it's very significant in terms of Bible prophecy, because the Belt and Road Initiative really seems to be laying the groundwork for some specific prophecies to be fulfilled. One of these is recorded in Isaiah chapter 23. That chapter prophesies that in the end time, there will be what's called a mart of nations that comes together and changes the world. And this mart is basically an enormous economic partnership. The scriptures say that one of the lead players will be a nation called Chittim, which is an ancient name for modern China. It also mentions Tyre, which is a city that represents modern Europe. And then Ezekiel chapter 27 is a related passage, and that says that Togarma will be brought into this equation, and that's an ancient name for the modern people of Japan. So these scriptures really show that these economic powerhouses, China, Japan, and Europe, they will work together to control global trade for a brief time. The Bible also shows that this will operate at America's expense, to the detriment of the U.S. So to see Japan today cooperating with China to build this ancient Silk Road that, you know, basically builds a huge trade route from Asia to Europe, it's easy to see that this Mart of Nations prophecy is in the process of being fulfilled. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about this Mart of Nations prophecy and the related scriptures, and we'll have a link to his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, which really thoroughly analyzes all of those passages.
All right, very good. We'll also put a link to Russia and China in Prophecy, which talks about the biblical underpinning behind this forecast of this Pan-Asian alliance that includes both China and Japan. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. We'll finish by talking about more record-breaking wildfires sweeping through California. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, California is currently being incinerated by its deadliest wildfire ever. The ironically named Camp Fire has scorched almost 120,000 acres. But it's not actually the fire's size that's attracting so many headlines. The Car Fire earlier this year actually charred more than double that much land. But like mentioned earlier, this is the deadliest fire, and that it's killed 42 people already, and hundreds more are missing. And so while there's definitely been bigger fires in more sparsely inhabited areas, the previous record for death was 29 people. And so this is already looks like it's going to more than double that. And we have an article by our editor-in-chief up on online right now entitled, Is California Under a Curse?, where he brings out that this is the 7 of the deadliest fires in California history have happened since 2017.
That's amazing.
And so you're just getting these worse and worse catastrophes. And he points to a Bible prophecy in Matthew 17, verses 10 and 11, where the disciples ask Christ, saying, "Why say the scribes that Elijah must first come?" And then Jesus answered and said unto them, "Elijah shall truly first come and restore all things." So this is an end time prophecy about a religious leader who would restore all the lost doctrines to God's church. And as the article explains, that religious leader was Herbert W. Armstrong, and his work was based in California. Yet the even though California probably received more of God's message than any other state, they rejected the message, and in 1979, the government of California even attacked the church and tried to take away its property and its financial reserves. And it shows that it is that act of hearing God's message and rejecting it that answers the question posed in the title of the article. It's like, is California under a curse? And the answer is yes. Soon all of the Bible prophecy mentions that all of America will be under a curse, but California is like the vanguard in getting the first dose of these curses because of that role in attacking the end time Elijah God sent specifically to work in their state.
That's quite a story, and it's amazing how many times it seems like we're covering the story, record-breaking wildfires sweeping across California. That's been happening so much. And we will put a link to that article, Is California Under a Curse, on the show notes for the program today. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub for links to that and to all the other articles and the literature that we discussed today. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. You can also email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much.
Theresa May is still Prime Minister.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Folk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of James Bryant Conant. Behold the turtle. He makes progress only when he sticks his neck out. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.